Coming up on Tech News Today, apparently RIM fired its best ideas. Windows 8 comes to the iPad, and why CISPA is actually worse than SOPA. All that and more coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for my lucky day, Friday, the 13th of April, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Gazelle, the easy way to sell or recycle your iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it. Find out how and what your gadget is worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we kick around the tech news of the day and make sense of it. We force it into a box. That makes sense.
Get in there.
Let me kick
in there,
it.
Tech news.
And it makes some sense.
No one puts tech news in a corner but us.
After we put it in a box.
And we tell it what it means.
What's in the box? Tech.
Metaphor got away from me. Let's go over to Jim Balsillie, shall we? The former exec at RIM apparently had some pretty decent ideas for how to fix RIM before they kicked him out.
Yeah, everyone was calling for the... Well, throw out the co-CEOs, get rid of Jim Balsillie, get rid of Lazaridis. But it turns out, Reuters reports that Jim Balsillie had a really interesting strategy for RIM. What RIM would allow wireless carriers to do is use RIM's private network to set up some data plans. Currently, RIM's network is only for BlackBerry devices. The strategy was vetoed by CEO Thorsten Heinz and the board, which the board included his old buddy Mike Lazaridis, said no. This led to Balsillie resigning because, well, this is kind of a business plan. Balsillie is the business guy. And the way this would work is that Balsillie had a lot of contact with a lot of the executives at telecoms because when the BlackBerry was picking up steam, he was negotiating with these people directly. What would happen is the carriers would use this network. It would offload the strain on their networks. Other phones could be on these things. Data plans would be on these particular devices. They would be limited to social media and IM. So that would get people to...
I love that.
But the idea would be like, oh, you get people to move away from feature phones to basically a starter smartphone and maybe for future things that way.
Kind of a stepping stone between the two?
Exactly. All right. The thing is, RIM's network services is high margin for this company. It earns them $1 billion per quarter. So after this deal was killed, the only thing that's left for RIM to do is sell BlackBerry 10 devices in September or October, whenever that happens. So that's it. That's the story from sources close to the matter. But it seems like a really interesting strategy from Jim Balsillie to set up RIM as, well, a network service provider.
Well, I feel a little bad because I know at the time when he was still at the company, I was one of the people saying, why isn't RIM doing something disruptive? Why aren't they changing their business model? Why aren't they doing something like sharing their infrastructure with other partners
and getting some
and make
money.
Some money that way.
Yeah, because now everyone has been, it's been very controversial and they've gotten a lot of flack for this whole BlackBerry 10 situation coming later this year when even fewer people will care.
Later and later this year.
Yeah.
Like, every time.
Better be the most amazing rollout we've ever seen of devices and software or, you know, that's it for them. But here's Balsillie saying, no, let's get actually different kinds of revenue so we don't have to put all of our eggs in that BlackBerry 10 basket.
And the carriers were on board with this idea originally because it does take some of the strain off of them. Because right now, RIM's devices use less bandwidth than other devices. But the fear was, okay, if RIM services go down, it's going to look bad for us. And that's happened. It's happened every now, not that
sure.
often. It's just a small concern. That's,
I mean, carrier services go down too. But
and the networks they were talking to, though, like we're talking Verizon, AT&T, Vodafone, Deutsche Telekom, a Canadian carrier that they didn't mention. But that would have been a huge shift for a long time. RIM could have been safe, but they decided against it.
Oh, well. Well, Jim Balsillie can go pursue his dreams of an NHL franchise now.
Which he actually does want to pursue.
Yeah, he might.
Not kidding.
Maybe he might be happier that way. I don't know.
It seems like a fun job.
Yeah, seriously. On to reports of a brand new Apple product. Like you've never heard a rumor about that before. But
this is revolutionary.
It is actually. There's a famous designer, legendary. The AFP calls him Philippe Starck. He designed the Virgin Galactic spaceport for instance. He's designed lots of yachts and alarm clocks and things like that. He was talking to the AFP.
You know, yachts, alarm clocks.
Well, you need alarm clocks on your yacht.
Things that are similar
you
to
gotta
other
things.
Got
to wake up to get to your yacht, you know.
You got to wake up on the yacht in style.
I just present the facts.
All right, all right.
AFP reporting that Stark said, quote, I have a big project with Apple. We have a big project together that will be out in 8 months. He also called it fairly, if not very, revolutionary. He's also a poet, apparently. So what could it be? New TV? Would he be involved in that? Is it something with the Apple Store? Because he's done a lot of outlets, retail outlets. Would it be the new Apple Campus? Would he be signing that? Well, an Apple spokeswoman said the company is not working on a new product with Stark. I guess that leaves the store and the campus, though. Those aren't products. However, All Things D points out that prior to his death, Apple CEO Steve Jobs was working with Stark on a yacht or possibly an alarm clock. But we think it was a yacht. No, it was a yacht to be built by luxury super yacht builder Feedship. You had your yachts built by them, right?
Yeah, that was a fierce competition of who was going to build my yacht, and Feedship won.
It's believed to have a minimalist and sleek design, the main feature being a 40-foot long glass wall or walls.
But this is not Philippe Stark and Apple collaborating on anything. If he built a yacht that maybe he talked to Steve Jobs about, which is probably why Apple's saying he's not
working on a product with us.
All right.
And he's like, yeah, well, and apparently he visited Steve Jobs once a month and he still visits
his wife.
So maybe maybe he thinks of that as Apple, even though it's not technically Apple.
I guess so.
Would the yacht be revolutionary because of the glass wall? Is that what it is?
I mean, well, think about it, right? If you are someone who is into yachts and there's a huge culture around yachts, most of us are not part of it because we can't afford yachts. But if you can, you're going to be into yachts and you're going to be into the design of them. And you always hear these stories about, you know, rich people designing their yachts to look cooler than the guy in the slip next door. And so that would be revolutionary. And legitimately so.
And it also explains the
eight-month
time period. Like, what's going to show up? It's going to be a boat. We know we're having it built. It's not like...
A ship,
excuse me. Because you don't want to be on a boat. You want to be on a ship.
I'm on a boat. Not.
Apple also in the news for their e-book price fixing. They finally came out with a statement. We've been talking about this for a few days. If you haven't heard, the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against 5 publishers and Apple, accusing them of collusion in fixing the prices of ebooks. Apple was lagging behind in their responses, but they have finally come out with a response. Tom Neumeier, Apple spokesman, told several news outlets, quote, "The Department of Justice's accusation of collusion against Apple is simply not true. The launch of iBook Store in 2010 fostered innovation and competition, breaking Amazon's monopolistic grip on the publishing industry. Just as we've allowed developers to set prices on the App Store, publishers set prices on the iBook Store." Other than saying the accusation of collusion is simply not true, all of the rest of his sentences have to do with the other part, which is we put the agency model of pricing into place. It doesn't really talk specifically about the collusion because, again, remember, this is easy to get confused. It's not the fact that they allowed the publishers to set the prices that's at issue here. It's that they all planned together to use this to push up prices.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, if the DOJ could prove it, what would be against the law and be collusion. We got an email from Matt in Lawrence, Kansas. It says, "Hey, TNT crew, I have some thoughts on the recent talk about the DOJ's case against publishers. A friend of mine spent some time working for one of the publishers accused in the case, and she insists that the accused collusion was a necessary evil to combat Amazon's business model. However, my personal belief is that there needs to be a paradigm shift in the monetization of books. I've seen several people compare this case to when music transitioned into digital. Musicians can't monetize their music by selling CDs, so they have to make money in other ways, usually by selling merchandise and touring. Two thoughts come to mind are ad-supported ebooks, which actually are being tried, and he says, I personally think people might find annoying, but could be a source of profit for authors, or a Spotify-esque service provided by the publishers. And Amazon is trying to make that happen. For some monthly fee, you get access to a certain number of ebooks from a publisher's catalog. This may allow for publishers and authors to still make money from writing, yet still allow for Amazon to price books cheaply. There may be other ideas for monetization, et cetera, et cetera. I just feel like publishers aren't trying to do that and are instead clutching to a dying industry.
These are interesting ideas. The ad-supported books, you could see people getting irritated with that. People got slightly annoyed with the Kindle that was ad-supported. But people, most of the times, if you get a discount on it, People are fine with that. If that can make revenue for these publishers, or this can make revenue for writers, that's really what's important here. It's interesting to think about how Amazon was so dominant in the ebooks system, such that the companies were afraid in the long run what's going to happen to these guys, that they were stupid enough to talk to each other about it. Like, that's what happened here. So I'm just kind of really curious where everyone's going to go, because you can't go back. You can't just be like, yeah, we're going to raise our prices by going to the agency model in a couple of years. And if they're not willing to try different things, what else can they do?
Don't you think it's almost obvious that people in top seats at publishing houses would be talking to each other? Now, collusion, I understand, is illegal. You can't do what the DOJ is accusing these publishers of doing. But it's not as if they don't know each other, and it's not as if they wouldn't say, like, hey, Amazon is really screwing us, right? They're screwing you too, right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could take back the night, the book night?
The falling night of declining print sales?
And I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, but it's like, it seems like a very obvious move for these publishers to just try to get back some control, because Amazon is not only taking control out of their hands, but control out of anybody who wants to compete with them. And nobody's as big as Amazon when it comes to books.
And that's what the crux of the case is. The publishers are saying what you're just saying. Like, look, we have to talk to each other. You know, we go to conferences, we see each other, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, we can't talk to each other in a collusive way because that's against the law, but we weren't. And so the Department of Justice is saying, well, we disagree. We think you were. And so that's what they're going to court to settle. Mm-hmm. Because it's perfectly logical that they could be discussing the industry, and they should be able to discuss the industry, and there's no law against that.
Yeah.
It's whether they pushed the industry into a certain way. And the other thing to remember here is the agency model actually makes them less money in the short term. What they were doing was saying, we want to make more money on print. We don't want print to decline fast, and we don't want power over the ebook market to concentrate in the hands of Amazon. We want to slow down the decline of print sales, and we want to stop another iTunes from happening to the ebook industry. So they were willing to do the agency model, which arguably doesn't make them as much money. So it's not even about a money grab necessarily. It's about controlling the industry and slowing the effects. To me, it's very easy for me to say, you know what, the effects are coming anyway, you might as well adapt now, because I don't run a publishing company.
Right.
But that is the case. You're eventually going to have to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, we see this with movies, we see this with music. I guess you kind of see this with TV shows as far as subscription models like Hulu. It's going to go in the direction it's going. It's just up to the publishers to try to figure out, okay, how can we make sure that we're not, you know, bleeding out money while still knowing that places like Amazon are going to undercut sales of books, and then we'll end up selling more books. And, you know, it's like,
undercut sales of books, the publishers still charge the same amount in the wholesale model.
Mm-hmm.
So they just don't like the fact that Amazon was undercutting the sales of books. They were still making plenty of money.
It wasn't the fear of the fact that Amazon, if they had that market share, then eventually could say, lower your prices on the books.
Exactly, right.
Because people then say, well, no. I mean, I pay $5 mm-hmm. per book
right.
for a
Amazon's
bestseller.
Been selling it that way forever.
Yeah.
And indie publishers and small bookstores have been railing against Amazon for that practice in print for decades now. And so it was pretty smart to want to prevent that from happening. This story is not going to go away anytime soon, but we'll probably not be covering it every day from now on for those of you who may be a little tired of it. But it is an interesting story, because ebooks were around a lot earlier than music or movies, but they're a lot later to this point in their development than music and movies were.
I think this whole conversation is exciting just because it's like, if no one was reading a lot of books, this would be so much less of a compelling argument, you know, to look at this from both sides. The fact that people just read a lot, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
And the fact that the industry is changing, and people who have been making a lot of money off of people reading are starting to get freaked out. But it's still based on the fact that people are reading awesome literature and nonfiction, and I love that.
And the Kindle is what caused this to be an issue.
Yeah.
Because suddenly there was a reasonably easy way to read an ebook, a pleasant way to read an ebook.
Somebody theorized the fact that why these book sales went up is that you can hide a Kindle and you can have like really silly things that you would never buy in a store, like, you know, like a Twilight or something. I wouldn't be caught dead with that book, but maybe I would put it on my iPad or my Kindle. You never would see it, right? This seems like that kind of. I can buy embarrassing things on a Kindle and you'll never see it.
Yeah, when you're sitting on the airplane or out at the coffee shop, nobody knows what you're reading.
Exactly.
So you can always pretend. You don't have to wrap your embarrassing bodice rippers in a philosophical book
dust jacket right.
anymore. Yeah. What was that?
That was the mic stand.
It was a horse.
Like a horse.
Sorry.
Yeah. And that horse noise lets us know it's time to move on to our sponsor. Thank you. Gazelle. If you want to buy an ebook reader, but you need some cash, try out Gazelle. We know you want some new gadgets. You want that new tablet. You want that new Android phone, that new iPhone, iPad. And this is a great way to make some money to help pay for those upgrades. If you've got an old MacBook, you've got an old iPhone, you got an old smartphone, go to Gazelle right now, GAZELLE.com. See what your gadget is worth, and you want to do it now because gadgets don't appreciate over time, sadly. They get less and less valuable. So don't put it off another day. Go to Gazelle.com, put in the name of your gadget, get a quote for them, be honest about the condition. In fact, if they think you're being too hard on it, they'll actually upgrade it for you and give you more than you thought you were going to get. If they're like, no, this is in good shape. They are. I've done it plenty of times. Believe me, they're very good about this. They did that to me one time. So, yeah, you just tell them what the condition is, what the wires are, what accessories you've got. They'll give you a quote. They'll give you a label for free shipping. You drop it off at the post office or the FedEx store or wherever you're sending it from. And very fast, you'll get money either by check, by PayPal, Amazon gift card, all kinds of ways to get money. And you can get it fast if you go do it now. Just like when you drive a car off the lot, your gadgets lose their value over time. So go to Gazelle.com now. Get the best offer. Find out what your gadget is worth. Don't just sell it. Gazelle it. I've made quite a bit of money this year cleaning out my garage and selling some gadgets to Gazelle. So check it out, GAZELLE.com. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. On to some Windows 8 news and iPad today in the news. On Thursday, remote desktop maker Splashtop is opening up a new iOS app called Win8 Metro Testbed. Splashtop is a maker of VNC software. I've used them before to control my Windows machines over an iPad. But they've made a special version that works really well with Windows 8. Because Windows 8 has that Metro interface for touchscreen, and they wanted to adapt it so that you feel like you're using Windows 8 on a tablet. And apparently, by all accounts, I haven't tried it myself, it works really well. There's CNET had an article with a review and a video, and it's pretty snappy. Now, it is expensive. It's meant for developers to test their apps. And so instead of having to buy a Windows 7 laptop for, you know, $1,000 or a Windows 7 tablet for $1,000, if you've already got an iPad, you buy their app for $50. Actually, it's discounted for a limited time to $25. So it's an expensive app, but it's cheaper than buying a tablet. And then you're able to run over your local network your Windows 8 machine. So you install Windows 8 on a desktop, and then you can control it from the iPad, but it's like you're controlling Windows 8 locally on the iPad.
It seems like a great idea, and I love the fact that they said, listen, everyone's got an iPad, especially a lot of these developers. We really want to entice them to make Windows 8 apps, so let's let them test it on a device that they already have. But what confuses me a little bit is why Apple would be totally cool with this app being available.
Well, it's just VNC. There's plenty of VNC apps. So I don't think Apple would have a defensible position, and not that that stopped them before, I get what you're saying, but to say like, well, we're not going to allow this app because it's controlling Windows 8 and all the other ones control Windows 7. I mean, you could conceivably do this with any VNC app.
Yeah, I guess
it's just
true.
Not as tuned to work well with the Metro interface as this particular one. I mean, there's the regular Splashtop app already that you could do this with.
Well, in a way, it almost gives them a leg up because they're like, we're the test machine.
Yeah.
Because everyone's got an iPad already. So this is the place that you want to test out your stuff no matter what you're developing for.
Apple's made those pokes at Microsoft every now and then. The best laptop out there for Windows is a MacBook. They go, it runs really well, that kind of.
I've said that for
years.
They've
done those ads. Yeah. They've said those things in those keynotes. But one of the things that Microsoft showed off in a bunch of videos was how important the hardware is for Windows 8 and that touch experience. And if you don't have edge-to-edge glass, like some of the older tablets that existed for Windows 7, they had like a bezel. And so when you were trying to do these swipes and you're trying to reach to the, for the charms on the right side, or you're trying to call up a different screen, you just couldn't do that. And so for developers to get their hands on Windows 8 capable tablets, it's very difficult. But iPads are out now. They have edge-to-edge glass. It has a lot of the hardware specs that you need to run this. So all the multi-touch support and all of that. This is very important for Windows 8's success. And it will make Apple some money, too. $50 and that get, you know, 30% of that every time they sell one. So why
not? They're not going to object too much to that. You know, and don't forget, we're not saying that this... PC Mag ran an article that kind of said, well, this could eat into sales of Windows 8 tablets. I don't really think it's going to. This is meant for developers. This is saying, look, if you're a developer who's working on a Metro app and you want to test it and you already have access to an iPad, this is a lot cheaper way to test your app than to go out and spend $1,000 on an existing Windows tablet, because the Windows tablets out there are $800,000 plus. So for $25 temporarily or $50 in the future, you save quite a bit of money and can test your app. Does it have a lot of other uses? Could it be used for people to run it? Sure. But remember, if you're out away from your Windows desktop, you may not be able to access it. There is a way to access it over the internet using a Google login, but if you have a power outage at home or whatever, you are accessing it over the network. It's not running locally on the iPad. So it's not exactly a replacement for the iPad interface, so to speak. A couple other things. In Beijing today, Intel lined out two Windows 8 tablets designs implementing Clover Trail. So they're still pushing their specs on Windows 8 tablets. And Microsoft is looking for volunteers to join an invite-only feedback program for active Windows 7 and Windows 8 consumer preview users in the United States. In return for providing your feedback, both by sending them your data, so you have to be comfortable with that, as well as filling out surveys, you'll get free software, Xbox games, Microsoft Office 2012, Kinect Disneyland, Forza Motorsport, stuff like that. So, you know, you might want to check that out.
It's an actually interesting switch for Microsoft for Windows 8. They weren't taking feedback on that at all. Windows 7, there was a lot of feedback on this. Now they're opening up a little bit.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what changes might come out of this.
Let's move on to the new SOPA, or at least that's what everybody calls it. This is CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, getting more and more attention out there. A lot of folks calling it worse than SOPA. Say hello to the new SOPA. This reminds you of SOPA. SOPA, of course, the Stop Online Piracy Act. They're not very similar, except in a few key ways. And I figured this is as good of a day as any on a Friday to kind of explain what's going on. First of all, there's actually four bills proposed in Congress, two in the Senate by John McCain and Joe Lieberman that are similar to this. They all involve cybersecurity. And there's two in the House. The most popular one is Representative Mike Rogers' CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. It focuses on facilitating information sharing both between the government and the private sector, and between the private network operators among each other. It exempts cybersecurity information sharing from other legal restrictions like confidentiality, trade secrets, etc. And it immunizes network providers from liability for failing to act on information they receive under provisions of the act. So one of the problems is if I know about a criminal activity that I have been, you know, that has been shared with me by the government, I could be liable for not reporting it, acting upon it, et cetera. So this is meant to ease the communication between the government and private networks to fight the bad guys. And that's actually the way Representative Mike Rogers pitches this. He says, the government has info that can help private companies stop hackers, but it's confidential and so illegal to share. Now, people disagree with him about that, whether it's actually illegal to share or not. Also, people disagree whether the government can really help stop hackers. That's a different story as well. CISPA would make it legal to share information between the government and private companies. It would also make it legal for the companies to share info voluntarily back with the government. The bill doesn't require tech companies to share data with the government, but it also doesn't require the government to share information with the tech companies. It just immunizes everybody. It says, mm-hmm. You know what? This is legal. You guys can share if you want to. Or one of the fears is it would set up a quid pro quo. So if the government hears a request like, hey, we're getting attacked, do you have any information you can share? The government can go, yeah, you know, we do have some information that would help you, but we'd like some information on some of your subscribers as well. Now, the ISP doesn't have to give it, but then the government doesn't have to give their information. So it could encourage some sort of informal quid pro quo that you have to share information with me if I'm going to share information with you.
I'm just thinking that's more of a failing of the government and, and behavioral problems with humans. It doesn't seem like this. I mean, the law does give you a little bit of leeway to be able to do this, but there's a larger problem there in general to say like, oh yeah, I'd be quid pro quo with this. And I know the people keep talking about this with SOPA, and I think that's a little strange because...
Wait, let me get to that.
Go ahead.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation worries that the language is so vague. That's really the big problem that critics have, is that the language in CISPA is vague. The EFF worries that the language allows private companies to share data with anyone, even other private companies, in the name of cybersecurity. That's where the SOPA comparisons come in, because you can construct a narrative that is plausible. It may not be likely, and it certainly isn't intended. This is not what Mike Rogers is not in bed with the MPAA on this, but the MPAA may not mind if CISPA gets passed, because someone could say, well, I have people committing crimes on my network, the crimes of illegal file sharing. And so in the name of cybersecurity, because cybersecurity is defined very vaguely, I am going to share information with the MPAA in order to fight the criminals and give a bunch of private information over to the MPAA without any government oversight or without any court order. Now, again, that's certainly not the intention, not likely to be what they're after, but could happen.
Right. And what I was going to say about the comparisons to SOPA, there is that scenario that could happen there. But the thing is, there's so many other reasons to dislike this bill. It's the vagueness entirely, that a scenario like that could be proposed and could go through. People don't know what kind of stuff is moving around between these agencies. And there's lack of definitions to cybersecurity.
Let's read the definition before you, and then I'll let you go on. Just so you know, this is what cybersecurity is defined as in the bill. Cybersecurity purpose means the purpose of ensuring the integrity, confidentiality, or availability of or safeguarding a system or network, including protecting a system or network from. Okay, so in other words, like all of these things and protecting a system or network from efforts to degrade, disrupt, or destroy such system or network, or theft or misappropriation of private or government information, intellectual property, or personally identifiable information. That intellectual property bit's the one that's got everybody comparing it to SOPA.
Yeah, that's extremely vague. It's like, okay, I guess that's what cybersecurity could be defined as, but you're not really saying anything.
You're saying data. You're almost defining all types of data.
Right, and to me, it looks a lot like file sharing. That really jumps out at me as like, this, you know, a cybersecurity threat such as file sharing.
Yeah.
You know, via Facebook Messenger or something.
And the other thing is the language says including protecting a system. So this is not even exhaustive. So we don't know what else is out there. It doesn't say limited to. So we have that problem. Theft or misappropriation of private or even intellectual property in this case. Now, the question is, what do they mean by theft? I know there was a Second Circuit ruling the other day where somebody downloaded some information for a trade secret. And they said that wasn't theft because the company still had it. Now, is theft limited to here to actually taking the file off of, let's say, Paramount servers, deleting it off of Paramount servers, and now you have it? Or misappropriation, which is the use, which could be you still have it and I have it. So that's there's not enough in here to go, okay, this is going to be clear. And if it's passed, then the courts have to figure this out, and that's going to take a very long time. And this is not something you necessarily want to happen. You want this to be as clear as possible before you pass this.
And remember, all of those things you said are true, and you don't have to prove that they're happening. This is protecting you in the case that you are sharing information in order to protect your system or network from degrading, from theft or misappropriation, right? You don't even have to be, you don't even have to have evidence that it's actually happening. You're saying like, you know what? We thought this might be an avenue where theft or misappropriation might happen. So we cooperated and shared your private information without your knowledge in order to prevent that from happening. I mean, this has got holes wide open in it that anybody could drive any kind of privacy violation through and say, you know what? Yeah, of course we took all of your Facebook contacts and shared them with the MPAA, but we were protecting our network from the possibility of someone stealing intellectual property.
That's right. Facebook is behind part of this. But then they put up a post today. I just saw this. It says, amongst a lot of things, a very long post, is the concern is that companies will share sensitive personal information with the government in the name of protecting cybersecurity. And it's in bold here. Facebook has no intention of doing this, and it is unrelated to the things we liked about H.R. 3523 in the first place. So they're saying right away, like, okay, there's there's a public relations
nightmare.
We might
be supporting this bill, but it's not for what you think. It's for all the good
and
stuff.
And that was the problem with the Stop Online Piracy Act. It was like, oh, no. We're not going to use it for shutting down people we don't like.
We never thought of it in that way.
I know it allows us to do that, but we would never use that.
Oh, no.
We would never use that gun to shoot you in the face.
Well, wait a second. There's some good theory to this. Execution, really poor. It's like you want to be able to share information to stop a network from being attacked. That's somewhat important. Because, you know, you kind of want your networks to be up.
Absolutely.
But if it's too vague, that's where the problem is.
And Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology says that he supports the goal of the cybersecurity bills, all four of them. He says if you're being attacked either in the real world or the cyber world, you're always permitted to disclose that information to the government. He suggested that what Congress should do is update wiretapping law to make it clear that service providers are allowed to share information about attacks with one another, that we should take a proscriptive approach and define what it is that needs to be clarified rather than taking this broad approach that says, let's just allow everything. That way, the things that we want to do will be legal. And here's why this, you know, forget about SOPA. This is, maybe it could be used by the MPA and that's going to bother people and it's going to get people all fired up to bring up that word again. But this is about the Department of Homeland Security and the National Security Agency being able to spy on the internet traffic and the internet private data of every single citizen of the United States without cause or warrant. And I think that's a little more disturbing than my copyright violations being sought after by the MPAA. This is serious privacy violation. This is the kind of thing that led to Watergate. The kind of thinking that led to Watergate, and we put in all kinds of wiretapping laws to stop that kind of thing from happening again. Those laws needed to be updated, for sure, in the world of the internet. But that doesn't mean we should just throw them out and say, yeah, you know what, we'll let the intelligence agencies spy on everyone in the country. Meanwhile, there's one ISP that wouldn't voluntarily cooperate with CISPA, even if it got passed.
Yeah, in fact, it would be it would make it impossible to coordinate anything with the government. Yesterday, CNET profiled a man named Nicholas Merrill, who's raising money to launch a national nonprofit telecommunications provider that's dedicated to privacy using ubiquitous encryption that would sell both mobile phone and internet service. The idea is to resell a wireless service like WiMAX and then add end-to-end encryption for browsing the internet, encrypted email, and so on. And if there's a legal court order, by the way, this is called the Calix Institute. That's what it's being proposed as. The Calix Institute would not be able to help. Merrill says the idea that we're working on is not to be capable of complying. So if government comes to them with a court order, they say, hey, we'd love to read this email, but we can't because of encryption. Now, the story got picked up yesterday by Reddit, and there's a donation page over at a service called Indiegogo. It works a lot like Kickstarter. In fact, Merrill says he wanted to host a donation page on Kickstarter, but because it wasn't an art based project, Kickstarter said no. So he's actually hosting a donation page over on Indiegogo. Now, as of yesterday, he had raised over $43,000. As of today, it's up another $3,000 or so. He's looking to raise $1 million. So still a long way to go, but a huge bump in its first day with over 60 days left to go. Now, apparently, Merrill's looking to raise about $2 million. But another million of that might come from private funding. He already has a travel grant from the Ford Foundation, which allows him to come to the Bay Area and San Francisco and meet with venture capitalists and individual angel investors who might be interested in helping sponsor this project. What's really interesting about this, though, not even beyond the fact that you might think it's a good idea, is that Nicholas Merrill has a lot of history with this sort of issue. As someone running an ISP, he used to run an ISP called Catalix Internet Access. He started in New York City in 1994, and it became a plaintiff in an original challenge against the constitutionality of national security letters in the Patriot Act. In February 2004, the FBI sent Merrill a national security letter. Wasn't an actual court order, wasn't signed by a judge, asking for information about his customers and forbid him from disclosing that the letter even existed. He went to the ACLU and said, this isn't right. ACLU fought the gag order and won. A federal judge barred the FBI from invoking that portion of the law, saying that's unconstitutional prior restraint of speech in violation of the First Amendment. Now, during this time, his identity was kept confidential for years. They were in litigation. In 2007, he posted an anonymous op-ed on the Washington Post and said, quote, "I resent being conscripted as a secret informer for the government, especially because I have doubts about the legitimacy of the underlying investigation." And he wasn't even able to discuss his case publicly until 2010, just a couple years ago. So this is somebody who has a long, arduous experience with the exact same thing that he doesn't want to repeat in the future, and says, "I want to build an ISP where I never have to go through this again, and neither do any of my customers."
And you know what's interesting is this actually makes a law like CISPA entirely irrelevant.
Exactly.
Because he's saying, not only will I not voluntarily comply, which is what CISPA requires, is you to voluntarily comply, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can't voluntarily comply because I've set up my network where I don't know what my customers are doing, and that's the way I want it. That's the way my customers want it, and I can run a better network that way. He's definitely not the first person to have this idea,
right?
But he seems to be very serious about making it happen, and he seems to have some qualifications and definitely, as you've explained, lots of motivation to do so as well.
A lot of motivation. At this point, it seems to be all about money, and it's hard to say that you know, the momentum of raising $40,000 a day.
In other words, he needs money to get it going. Yeah.
He needs money to get it going. This is the typical, get me enough money so that I can get this thing off the ground, because you can't just start an, you know, ISP and start reselling WiMAX just because you want to. That said, it's sort of a, you know, there's a rallying cry going on. He's certainly gotten a lot of attention, and he seems to have a really good idea and know what he's doing based on his prior experience.
Well, we would love to bring you the news fuse next, but we need our Kickstarter to reach 50,000. No, we actually do the news fuse as a bonus for free.
Buy we'll us give it a to yacht. You
today.
Yeah. Although we would take a yacht. I love that one. Where'd that one come from?
Oh, we played it before. It's Patrick Delahanty.
Oh, thank you, P. Delahanty. I do recognize it, but we haven't played it a lot. That's
played it
awesome.
A couple of weeks ago.
For those on the audio podcast, Minecraft News Fuse intro. The game is afoot at Valve, folks. The company recently posted a job listing that mentions Valve is developing hardware. In other Valve news, Apple CEO Tim Cook was recently spotted at Valve headquarters. Maybe Cook is tired of his job at CEO, wants to become a game developer, or more likely he has some ideas about gaming on Macs.
Whoa, would you look at the time? It's time for Patent Wars!
And TriCaster just totally locked up. Hold on.
TriCaster ruined your joke.
I know, right? I haven't even had Patent Wars in like over a week.
What did you do to TriCaster?
Hold on. There we go. Okay, for the rest of the show, I'm doing this with a mouse.
A German regional court affirmed a lower court ruling that Apple's iCloud and MobileMe services are infringing on Motorola Mobility patents. The patents relate to push email notification. In the U.S., a district court granted Microsoft's temporary restraining order, which stops Motorola from exercising whatever relief it gets from a German court.
Yeah, they're also in a patent suit over there.
Yeah.
Graham Fee reports that in 10 days, Instagram has racked up 10 million more users, bringing its total user base to 40 million. A lot of that growth can be chalked up
to the randomizer.
Well, the randomizer probably helped a bit, but
let go. I have it back.
The growth can be chalked up to that whole, you know, Android app and maybe that interest on the Facebook purchase.
Yeah, well, but everybody was so mad. I'm quitting Instagram. Apparently not. At least not in large enough numbers. Google Drive. It's kind of the same thing. Online diagramming tool Lucidchart published a control panel page touting Google Drive integration. Lucidchart would allow you to automatically sync your documents to your Drive account if you want. And they just have a page up saying, here's how we integrate with the Google Drive. Except no one's ever admitted there's a Google Drive. So what are you saying, Lucidchart?
Sharp televisions are about to get thinner and more power efficient. The company has been producing LCD panels that use indium gallium zinc oxide semiconductors for the past month and has ramped up production due to increased demand. Buy your Sharp televisions.
That's different.
Netflix, that is actually sharp. Netflix will release the source code for its cloud software, which have monkey-based nicknames. I'm not really sure why that is. Anyway, Netflix says the plan is to, quote, release pretty much all our platform, including the monkey infrastructure, over the rest of the year. The company hopes this move will help it find talented people to join its team.
A Twitter post by Boxy says that Boxy has 2 million users total, but only 200,000 Boxy box users. For some comparison, the Apple company, you heard of them, sold 1.4 million Apple TV units last quarter, and Google TV has about 1 million units out there. But you know what? Boxy's scrappy. They're going to stay in this fight.
Fast Company reports that Amazon's touted 17,000 movies and television shows for its Prime Instant Video service is massively inflated. Amazon counts individual episodes of television shows because it offers about 150 television series and around 1,700 movies.
So that they have like 2,200?
Fuzzy math.
Something yeah, you like put that. MASH in there, and suddenly they've got a huge catalog.
MASH Whatever, thousands Amazon. Of shows.
We're on to you and your monopolizing ways.
E-booker.
Yeah, horse e-books.
Oracle and Google's battle continues, and the court wants to know the positions on the following. Are computer programming languages copyrightable? Google says, nope, not at all. Oracle, on the other hand, says that a computer language may, quote, qualify for copyright protection if it is sufficiently original. Now, the court hasn't decided what's going on there, but that would have really far-reaching implications if you could copyright a programming language.
But it's similar to the code theft case. There's all this, you know, what is code, really?
Can you patent this? Can you trademark on this? What can you do on it? And this could be a long time.
You know what we can do with code? We can launch the randomizer.
For reals.
For reals.
This time. Look at all that code.
It'll show up randomly. Wow.
Okay, so we all had different reactions to this story that we saw. It's coming from The New Scientist, but we saw it on Engadget. Fujitsu's K supercomputer, forget about it. Yesterday's News says Engadget. Researchers at Kobe University and the University of the West of England's Unconventional Computing Center have discovered that properly herded crabs can single and, or, and not arguments essential to computers. So, yes, you could do live crab computing. Now,
my first reaction is, are the crabs happy or are they suffering?
And they seem pretty happy, although they do scare them into merging different herds to make, I think it's the Or Gate.
Mm-hmm.
You force swarms of crabs into one another with shadows that make them think a bird is about to eat them.
I don't know how nice that is.
It's not terribly nice, but they're on... They're otherwise living a normal crab life.
Yeah, I mean, it's like free range. Yeah. As long as I feel like they're on some sort of a nice sandy pasture.
The picture is of them on a sandy clouds. Beach, but I don't know if that's the actual crabs or not. Jason, what was your reaction?
Fear-based computing.
Yeah.
It's the next wave, basically.
Yeah, I just can't wait to see the other IT admins who are worried about their crabs. And they're like, okay, what's going on with this? Do we have crabs today? What if they die? What are you doing then? You're out of your and? More and.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's very redundant because you have hundreds of crabs. So if you die, you can still...
A redundant array of crabs.
Yeah.
Okay.
A rack. That's the name, rack space.
Then you have to keep them chilled. And I guess this could be an interesting future. If I can't wait for our crab computers downstairs in the Twit studio. Excited?
Delicious. Is what that's
delicious.
Right. No, Tom, no. This is not about eating crab.
When they crash, we make crab cakes.
This is what worries me about this whole thing.
That was my reaction.
Everyone will end up eating the crabs.
Stop eating the computer.
It won't be about computing at all.
I've overclocked it, and it's butter cooled. Let's move on to the calendar.
An organization called Groupies is offering the Be Mine 2 bundle. It's actually really cool. 5 indie games and extra content for a minimum donation of $4. It'll get you Beat Hazard, Madballs and Babbo, Invasion, Plainsight, Soul Survivor, a game called The Baconing, and a first-person shooter called Killing Floor. Every $2 goes to an organization called Feed Them With Music. They organize concerts and other events that's aimed at helping feeding people who are hungry, paying for a meal. $10 covers 5 meals, and if you want more information, this is a really, really good deal. It's at Groupies, groupees.com/BeMine2. The number 2.
They give them more than just the concerts. They actually give them food. Feed Them With Music is not a threat.
Yes, yes, no.
Let them eat music.
Sorry for laughing, but no. They have to sit there and listen to music and be less hungry.
It's actually a really cool program.
Raising money through concerts to feed people who need it. Sprint is replacing the iDEN network with LTE by 2014. They say the 800 megahertz network will provide additional coverage alongside the 1900 megahertz LTE rollout and Clearwire's 2500 megahertz service, which will launch in 5,000 LTE cell sites by June of next year and will, by the end of next year, cover 250 million people. Monday, the 16th, ultraviolet in-store disc conversion is beginning in Walmart. So here's what you do. You bring in your DVDs and your Blu-rays. You get them converted into digital ultraviolet files hosted by Vudu. Standard def digital copies of DVDs and HD digital copies of Blu-rays will cost $2 each. And then Walmart will also allow customers to get HD digital files of their DVDs for $5.
Or you can download Handbrake.
Or that.
Break the law.
Or that. Jury selection for the Oracle versus Google trial is set to start Monday in an SF federal court. That's San Francisco. Oracle claims that Android's operating system violates patents related to the Java programming language, and Google says, no, we don't. And finally, Spotify's got a special announcement next week. They are really good at announcements. They're an announcement company. This is Wednesday the 18th in New York, featuring CEO Daniel Ek. We don't know what it is, but we'll find out soon enough. I mean, they're on fire.
Yeah.
Their announcements.
I just get excited that they're announcing an announcement. That's announcement enough for me right there. And then you get a bonus announcement on top of it.
We're going to add more buttons.
We're going to add more spots.
Spotify buttons.
Let's check what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Okay, so yesterday on the show, if you missed it, we tried to play Alex's voicemail. We have gone through significant testing. We put this through beta testing with an audience, and now we're ready to play Alex's voicemail about Google Plus and banners. He's saying banners.
Hi, this is Alex. When you talked about this Google Plus redesign thing, Sarah asked, why not call it Banner? Well, because Banner is the worst name ever. Half of the people, when they hear Banner, think annoying, flashing advertisement, and the other half think Lou Ferrigno smashing things. But nobody thinks about Google Plus. It's smashing or flashing. Not a good word. No.
Okay, fine. Don't call it Banner. Just don't call it cover photo.
What's wrong with it? I like cover photo.
Because
that makes
Facebook
sense to me.
Just did that, and it makes it seem like Google's just copying what Facebook's doing. That's
but it
all.
Existed before. We had this argument already, but
I'm just
Google Plus smash.
Don't call it Banner. Call it, I don't know.
A ribbon.
Special picture.
Call it the
logo.
The, I don't know.
That's probably
I don't
what
have
happened.
Anything good.
That's cover
that's
picture.
Exactly how, that's how the meeting went. They're like, just call it cover.
The white space remover.
How about personal landscape?
We actually have an email about white space about the white space part of Google.
Yeah, this one comes from Jacob Bodner. He says, the manufactured story of the week seems to be the whole outrage over white space on the new Google Plus page. Got me thinking, is there really more white space than any other website? So I did some measuring. I have a 1920 by 1080 display, so I do get a lot of white space. But it turns out the big block of white space on the right side of Google Plus is only about 650 pixels by 770 pixels. Or 500,500 square pixels. Compare that to the two Facebook white has two blocks of white space. The left one measuring 380 by 900 pixels, and to the left 500 by 900 pixels for a combined 792,000 square pixels. So Facebook actually has more white space. I think the whole problem would be fixed if Google would just have centered the content between the left pane and the chat section, like the image attached an image to show that. Just his two cents. You know, Tony Wang said the same thing to me after the TNT where we were talking about white space, and he's like, the white space is good though, because then when you're incorporating chat windows,
yeah,
when you're on Google Plus,
it's good to have space.
Then they're
stuff.
In this nice space, and it doesn't seem so crowded. That actually only works if you scroll past what's in the white space at the top of the page. But yeah, I do think that this is a little overblown.
It's not that white space is a bad thing. I mean, ask any designer. The proper use of white space is essential to good design.
Right.
I think what's bothering people is in certain resolutions and screen sizes, the white space doesn't look right, even though it's good. In certain situations, it's when it's empty, it just looks weird.
Wasn't the original design centered? I mean, it was just right there, so you had white space on the left and right. I don't know why people didn't complain about that. I didn't like it. I don't usually maximize my windows, though.
Well, white space on an edge is fine. It's white space in the middle that's what bothers people, I think.
Look at Twitter, web Twitter, obviously, not any of the third-party apps. It's a ton of white space. You just don't see it because we all put our customized backgrounds behind our page. But if you were to strip that out, I mean, it's a ton of unused space, and it's a design thing. They just, you know, it's better than it being messy and full of junk.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But also, the Google Plus white space doesn't bother me.
I mean, me either.
Because in theory, I totally agree with you, and I know that's why people are saying it bothers them. It just doesn't bother me.
I'll pretend to be outraged. I'm outraged.
All right. You be outraged.
Okay.
I'm going to tell people about our subreddit. Because we're very close to having 6,000 people in it, and you should be one of them. TechNewsToday.reddit.com is the place where we look to find out what stuff you're interested in having us talk about. We do look at our feeds, and we look at Google News, and we look at Tech Meme and places like that. But this is a great balancing act to those media outlets to say, well, what are actual users wanting to hear us talk about? So go there, submit some URLs, vote them up or down. We look at it every day to help us make our lineup. And also, if you liked a particular part of our show at any point during the week, send it to us with the subject line best of to tnt@twit.tv. And it helps us build a list of the best moments of the year so Jason can put them together in a nice big montage highlight episode at the end of the year. Which
for you.
We do. Yeah, exactly. I mean, what are we doing? If we're not doing it for us.
Not for our health, that's for sure. Yeah. What we drink red wine for.
Not doing it. I want to thank myself for being here today and let you know about my new show, SwordandLaser.com. I really don't love to self-plug a lot, but I'm really excited about this show. Go to youtube.com/geekandsundry and check it out. Veronica Belmont and I took our science fiction and fantasy book club, which Leo Laporte helped to found, by the way, and we have taken it to YouTube. And it's our first video version of it. So give it a sample. If you like, subscribe. And you might want to look at the other stuff on Geek and Sundry, because Will Wheaton does a tabletop gaming show and Felicia Day does a blog and there's some really awesome stuff. Dark Horse Comics has motion comics, so check it out, youtube.com/geekandsundry, and big thanks to them for allowing us to do the show. I hope you like it. We've been very nervous about the first episode, but it seems to be going well. That's it for this episode of Tech News Today. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call, 260-TNT-SHOW. Natalie Morris, for real this time, joins us on Monday. See you then.
You look just like the Kool-Aid guy. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.